All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, September 19th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is a sunny and pleasant 68 degrees here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show BCI, as in Brain Computer Interface, Brains, AI, Photons, Neurons, Optogenetics, and Quantum. We looked at a lot of strange technologies that they have been experimenting with, and one is optogenetics, the ability to use flashes of LED light to be able to cause a chemical change in the neurons of the brain. And according to a National Institute of Health study that we were reading, they are hoping to create a remote control for the brain. Now, as we have dug deeper into artificial intelligence, we have found that this Obama initiative called the Brain Initiative has been dumping millions, if not billions, of dollars into brain research, and it's all in the name of curing you, and don't worry about it. But as we are watching artificial intelligence march forward, and we have all kinds of Wall Street stories about it being a blooming market for investment, you have to wonder about what the end result is going to be and what the actual plans are. There was a story the other day. We have this newfound World War III that is happening between artificial intelligence and AI weaponry and utilizing energies and frequencies and things of that nature. I don't know if we covered this one or not, but I was pretty surprised that stories are coming out in mainstream. This one happens to be the Associated Press. This came out September 14th, 2017, a few days ago. U.S. diplomat in Cuba claims that he was attacked in bed after walking through, quote, some invisible wall. Now, there have been stories about diplomats in Cuba claiming that they've been attacked and there's been brain damage involved. They were talking about it being some sort of sound weapon. We had read the other day about a new threat to our Internet of Things devices, and that would be sonic attacks using sounds just outside of the hearing range to be able to turn things on and off, almost like kind of some of the stuff we saw in the optogenetics using light, be able to flip little switches. Listen to this. The blaring, grinding noise jolted the American diplomat from his bed in a Havana hotel, and he moved just a few feet and there was silence. He climbed back into bed inexplicably, and the agonizing sound hit him again. It was as if he had walked through some invisible wall, cutting straight through his room. Soon came the hearing loss and then the speech problems, symptoms both similar and altogether different from the other 21 U.S. victims in an astonishing international mystery still unfolding in Cuba. The top U.S. diplomat called them, quote-unquote, health attacks, and new details learned by the Associated Press indicate that at least some of the incidents were confined to specific rooms or even parts of rooms with laser-like specificity, baffling U.S. officials who say that the fact and the physics just don't add up. Now, of course, if our guys started going, oh, that sounds like a sound weapon using some sort of laser or ultrasonic technology, they'd be letting the cat out of the bag. They've already been experimenting with stuff like that. None of this has a reasonable explanation, says Fulton Armstrong, a former CIA official who served in Havana long before America reopened the embassies there. It's just a mystery after mystery after mystery, he says. Suspicion initially focused on a sonic weapon and on the Cubans, but yet the diagnosis of mild brain injury, considered unlikely as the result of sound, has confounded the FBI, the U.S. State Department, and the U.S. intelligence agencies involved in the investigation. Some victims now have problems concentrating or recalling specific words, several officials said, the latest sign of more serious damage than the U.S. government initially realized. The United States first acknowledged the attacks back in August, 9 months after symptoms were first reported. It may seem like the stuff of sci-fi novels, of the cloak and dagger rivalries that haven't fully dissipated despite the U.S. historic U.S.-Cuban rapprochement 2 years ago that seemed to bury the weight of the two nations' Cold War enmity. But this is Cuba, the land of poison cigars, exploding seashells, and covert subterfuge by Washington and Havana, where the unimaginable in espionage has often been all too real. The Trump administration still hasn't identified a culprit or a device to explain the attacks. And according to the interviews with more than a dozen current and former U.S. officials, Cuban officials, and others briefed on the investigation, most weren't authorized to discuss the probe and demanded anonymity. In fact, almost nothing about what went down in Havana is clear. Investigators have tested several theories about intentional attack by Cuba's government, a rogue faction of its security forces, and a third country like Russia or some combination thereof. Yet they've left open the possibility an advanced espionage operation went horribly awry or some other less nefarious explanation is to blame. Now, you remember when we were first looking at microwaves and frequencies, we found out that what got us actually involved in doing the research is that the embassies in Russia, they were accused of attacking our embassies in Russia. That was back in the 1950s or 60s with microwave sonic weapons. And there is a whole section in the microwave spectrum frequency that can cause sound and auditory issues. Aside from their homes, officials said Americans were attacked in at least one hotel, a fact not previously disclosed, and an incident occurred on an upper floor of a recently renovated Hotel Capri, which is a 60-year-old concrete tower steps from Malecón, Havana's iconic waterside promenade. The cases vary deeply, different symptoms, different recollections of what happened, and that's what makes the puzzle so difficult to crack. In several episodes recounted by U.S. officials, victims knew it was happening in real time, and there was strong indications of a sonic attack. Some felt vibrations or heard sounds, loud ringing or a high-pitched chirping, ding-ding, similar to cicadas or crickets or some sort of sonic attack. Others heard a grinding noise, and some victims awoke with ringing in their ears and fumbled for their alarm clocks, only to discover the ringing stopped when they moved away from their beds. The attack seemed to come at night, and several victims reported that they came in minute-long bursts, yet others heard nothing, felt nothing. Later, the symptoms came. The scope keeps widening. On Tuesday, the State Department disclosed that doctors had confirmed another two cases, bringing the total American victims to 21. Some have mild traumatic brain injury, known as concussion, and others permanent hearing loss. And even the potential motive is unclear. Investigators are at a loss to explain why Canadians were harmed also, including some who reported nosebleeds. Fewer than 10 Canadian diplomatic households in Cuba were affected, a Canadian official had said. And unlike the U.S., Canada has maintained warm ties to Cuba for decades. Sound and health experts are equally baffled. Targeted, localized beams of sound are possible, but the laws of acoustics suggest that such a device would probably be large and not easily concealed. Officials said it is unclear whether the device's effects were localized by design or due to some other technical factor. And no single sonic gadget seems to explain such an odd, inconsistent array of physical responses, brain damage, and concussions. It's not possible, says Joseph Pompei, a former MIT researcher and psychoacoustics expert. Somebody would have to submerge their head into a pool lined with very powerful ultrasonic transducers, like maybe inside the walls of the newly renovated hotel room. Other symptoms have included brain swelling, dizziness, nausea, severe headaches, balance problems, and tinnitus, prolonged ringing in the ears. And many victims have shown improvement since leaving Cuba, and some have suffered only minor or temporary symptoms. After the U.S. complained to the Cuban government earlier this year and Canada detected its own cases, the FBI and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police traveled to Havana to investigate. FBI investigators swept the rooms looking for devices, and they found nothing, several officials briefed on the investigation said. In May, Washington expelled two Cuban diplomats to protest the communist government's failure to protect Americans serving there. but the U.S. has taken pains not to accuse Savannah of perpetrating the attacks. It is a sign, investigators believe, even if the elements of Cuba's security forces were involved, it wasn't necessarily directed from the top. Cuba has never, nor would it ever, allow the Cuban territory to be used for any action against accredited diplomatic agents or their families without exception, the Cuban statement had said. After half a century of estrangement, the U.S. and Cuba in 2015 restored diplomatic ties between the countries separated by a mere 90 miles of water. Embassies were reopened and restrictions on travel and commerce eased. But Donald Trump has reversed some of those changes, but he left others in place. Mark Feierstein, who oversaw the Cuban Dante and President Obama's National Security Council, noted that Cuban authorities have been uncharacteristically cooperative with the investigation. Wink, that should be giving it away there. If Trump administration felt confident that Raul Castro's government was to blame, it's likely the U.S. would have already taken major punitive steps like shuttering the newly reestablished American embassy. And the U.S. hasn't stopped sending new diplomats to Cuba, even as the victim list grows. So go down there, Johnny. It's your turn. Had they thought that the Cuban government was deliberately attacking American diplomats, that would have been a much more negative effect, Feierstein had said. We haven't seen that yet. So why did I bring this up? Well, as we are looking at, like I said, optogenetics and little flashes of LED light being able to activate or silence neurons in the brain, makes you wonder if there aren't some other types of newfangled 21st century weaponry being used on the public at large. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of attention deficit disorder, and I've mentioned this before. I've had a lot of friends tell me that they see the same thing I do when their kids get in front of a screen, whether it be the television or a device or a computer game. There is always a change in their personalities. The kids become very disagreeable. And it's that dangling dopamine carrot that comes into play. Maybe there's something even more insidious going on. These little flashes of light, boop, 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 can flip little switches. And I don't quite know what all these switches do, but this kind of gave something away if I can get there. Uh-oh. I'm doing something completely new today. And it's giving me a few issues. This came out of Berkeley. Berkeley is another one of those lizard's pits. With a flash of light, a neuron's function is revealed. And this was from September 16th, 2009. So this was 8 years ago. Using light, scientists traced a fish's swimming response to the neurons that control it. Their technique could become a powerful new way to learn how biological systems work. There's a new way to explore biology's secrets, and that is with a flash of light. Scientists from the U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and University of California, Berkeley, zeroed in on one type of neural cell that controls swimming in larval zebrafish. Using innovative light-activated proteins and gene expression techniques, the scientists zapped several zebra fish with a pulse of light and initiated a swimming action in a subset of fish that was traced back to the neurons that drive the side-to-side motion of their tail fins. The technique behind this needle-in-a-haystack search for the neural roots of a specific behavior could become a powerful way to learn about how biological systems work. Ding, ding, ding. This is what they've been doing the last 8 years, little flashes of light to see what switches they flip in somebody's brain. The light-activated protein could also become a handy tool in the field of synthetic biology, in which scientists seek to identify a useful network of proteins in one microbe and import it into another microbe, a method that could be used to optimize the development of biofuels and disease-fighting therapies, like for mental disease, to name a few applications. Their work was published in the September 17th, 2009 issue of the journal Nature. This is a very unique way of arriving at an individual cell by starting with the behavior it controls, says Ehud Iskoff, a biophysicist who holds joint appointments with Berkeley's Lab of Physical Biosciences and Material Sciences Division and UC Berkeley's Department of Molecular and Cellular Biology. This research is an ongoing collaboration between Claire Wart, a scientist at ISCOF's UC Berkeley lab, Filippo Delbel of Herwig Bayer's UC San Francisco lab, and Dirk Tronner of the University of Munich. And remember, we tied this back to Germany yesterday. Current scientists often determine a neuron's function via correlation. If a group of neurons activates every time the animal performs a certain behavior, then chances are these neurons control that behavior. The same goes if the neurons are disrupted. If that behavior stops, then the affected neurons likely controlling it are as well. But we want to move beyond correlation and actually test causality. We want to play a behavior back to the nervous system and determine if individual neurons that are directly responsible, and this has been very difficult to do until now, the key to the scientist's success is an artificial light-activated protein they developed a few years ago. The protein can be genetically engineered to express in a neuron and other type of cell function and act as an optical switch, zap that protein with one color of light, and it switches on and activates its host neuron. Zap it with another color of light, and it turns off, and the neuron becomes dormant. Ding, ding, ding. Now, let's think about this one. We had read something yesterday about them using viruses and plasmids to be able to infect, I think they were talking about mice at that time, to get these different genetically modified fluorescence proteins into the brains to then be able to manipulate them with their light flashes in different wavelengths. First, they randomly expressed the protein in the genome of hundreds of larval zebrafish. Some light-activated switches popped up in muscle cells, some in bone, and some in the central nervous system. Next, they chose only those fish which were light-activated proteins was expressed in the neural cells in the spinal cord, some of which are known to control locomotion. Then they zapped these fish with light, and like dutiful servants, ding, the handful of fish spontaneously flicked their tails side to side in a swimming motion. Ho-ho! This is total remote control. Further analysis led the scientists to the neural source of this behavior. All of the swimmers had the optical switch expressed in a cell called the Kalmar-Alder neuron, whose existence has been known for more than 75 years, but whose functionality has remained a mystery. Our techniques allow us to identify previously unknown parts of the neural circuits that control behavior, says ISCOF, and this approach can be broadly used. What we have done with locomotion can be done with any behavior in many biological systems. Look out, people. As we found out yesterday, supercomputing is allowing us to map the brain function at its deepest levels. Oh, yes. Humanity has had so much to gain from a map of the human brain's neural connections. But while producing that map sounds simple enough in theory, it's extremely difficult in practice. Our brains have some 100 billion neurons making 100 trillion connections. And mapping this massive amount of information requires what we pinpoint the exact location of every single neuron before we can even hope to understand how they communicate with one another. And again, Georgie Porgy Church is barcoding all of our neurons using a fluorescence approach, which is also what they talked about. Taking a team approach to this task can make it slightly less daunting, and that is exactly what two researchers from the U.S. Department of Energy's Argonne National Laboratory is doing with their new Brain Connectome project. Researchers at Argonne's Advanced Photon Source, its goal is to fully map the human brain, but first they are starting relatively small by mapping the 75 million neurons in the brain of an adult mouse via a combination of data mining and machine learning. They're using AI, of course. And this is using Theta, which is a 9.65 petaflop Intel Cray supercomputer that is housed in the Argonne Computing Facility. Says machine learning will go through these data sets and help come up with predictive models. And for this project, it can help with segmentation or reconstruction of the brain and help classify or identify features of interest. And after they complete their analysis, they hope to move on to a larger mouse and then maybe to a non-human primate. And while the technique won't be ready for the complexity of a human brain for a little bit of while right now. Implications could be tremendous. A map of every connection in the brain could help us understand and identify the small changes that can signal the development of neurological disorders, whether accidentally or on purpose, such as Alzheimer's or autism. And such knowledge of the brain's wiring could also lead to the development of better treatments for such disorders, like a few flashes of light. Boop, boop, turn that neuron off. Furthermore, this level of brain mapping could assist us in more futuristic endeavors, such as engineering neurons themselves through synthetic biology or the creation of advanced brain-computer interfaces. This could also lead to the development of better artificial neural networks, which are designed to mimic how the human brain works. Ultimately, the team's research could inspire other projects that take advantage of supercomputing for seemingly impossible endeavors. By developing and demonstrating rapid analysis techniques such as data mining, graph analytics, and machine learning, and running all of our human scans through these tools, together with workflows that facilitate productive usage on our systems for applications, we will pave the way for more and more science communities to use supercomputers for their big data challenges in the future. Where's this all going to end up? Well, I hate to say it, guys, but it doesn't look good for us. I found a new story. This came out September 14th, 2017. Discovery of a new mechanism for controlling memory. Oh, now we read a story back a few months ago, and this one was from, let's see, February 23rd, 2016, last year. New study implies memories can be rewritten using optogenetics. Ding, ding. Researchers from Oxford University suggest that optogenetics may be the key to addressing addiction at a neurological level. Apart from detox and a long, arduous rehabilitation process, there are a few things that science can do to reverse conditions such as addiction, but scientists from the University of Oxford have managed to rewrite positive memories that drug-addicted mice have associated with cocaine. This breakthrough could provide major insight into how science can be used to neurologically reverse deep-seated bad behavior. And neurologists behind the study, Stephanie Trouche and David Dupre, started by training mice to choose specific locations using cocaine, poor little mousies, to alter the positive associations that the mice have since attached to it. The scientists used a genetic technique called optogenetics, where living brain cells are controlled using fiber optic cables. So this is direct connect versus just flashes of LED. And after the therapy, the mice successfully lost their preference for the cocaine-associated environment, implying that therapy allowed their memories to be rewritten. Their findings have been published in the journal Nature Neuroscience. And while training the mice, the option between an environment linked to saline solution and cocaine was given, and unsurprisingly, the mice would opt for the cocaine-associated environment. But after that was done, the team identified the cells in the mouse's brain that were active when they were in the cocaine-linked environment so that the cells would express light-sensitive proteins. And while the mice wandered about the cocaine environment, scientists switched on the light, which then silenced the tagged neurons. Ding, ding, ding. This is exactly the technology we've been talking about. This one, of course, using LEDs versus LED lights, but it makes physical switches on and off in your brain. This isn't just CRISPRing DNA anymore. This is flipping live brain cells. The process then caused unmasked neurons to activate, thus creating an alternative cognitive map. As a result, the mice lost their preference for the cocaine-associated site, and this affirms that memories are stored as biophysical or biochemical changes in the brain caused by external stimuli. It also implies that destructive behaviors such as addiction can potentially be rewritten via optogenetics. So then a new story comes out. This one was September 14th, 2017. Discovery of a new mechanism for controlling memory. Researchers in Bordeaux recently discovered a new mechanism for storing information in synapses as a means of controlling the storage process. The breakthrough moves science closer to unveiling the mystery of the molecular mechanisms of memory in learning process. The research, carried out primarily at researchers at the Interdisciplinary Institute for Neuroscience in Bordeaux, appeared in September 13th, 2017 edition of Nature. Communications between neurons passes through over 1 million billion synapses, tiny structures of a tenth of a width of a single hair, in an extremely complex process. Synaptic plasticity, which is the ability of synapses to adapt in response to neuronal activity, was discovered nearly 50 years ago, leading the scientific community to identify it as a functional component of memorization and learning. Neurotransmitter receptors found at the synaptic level play a key role in the transmission of nerve messages. And a few years ago, the team of researchers in Bordeaux discovered that neurotransmitter receptors were not immobile as thought previously, but in a state of constant agitation. They posited that controlling this agitation through neuronal activity could modulate the effectiveness of synaptic transmission by regulating the number of receptors present at a given time in a synapse. The new research has taken the two teams further in their understanding of the basic mechanisms behind how information is stored in the brain, and scientists combine techniques based on chemistry, electrophysiology, and high-resolution imaging to develop a new method to immobilize receptors at the synaptic site. This method successfully stops receptor movement, making it possible to study the impact of immobilization on brain activity and learning ability. It provides evidence that receptor movement is essential to synaptic plasticity as a response to intense neuronal activity. So I don't know. It's a whole bunch of gobbledygook. So how do they do it? Researchers also explored the direct role of synaptic plasticity in learning. By teaching mice to recognize a specific environment, they learned that halting receptor movement can be used to block the acquisition of this type of memory, confirming the role of synaptic plasticity in this process. So they can not only change memories, but they can block memories as well. This discovery offers a new perspective on controlling memory. The memorization protocol tested here activates a particular area of the brain, and that would be the hippocampus. The next step for researchers is to determine if the mechanism discovered can also be applied to other forms of learning and, by extension, to other areas of the brain. From a technical standpoint, it will be possible to develop new, reversible, light-sensitive, ding-ding methods of immobilizing receptors in order to better control the process. So there you have it. Light-controlled, ding-ding, optogenetics flashing in your little mobile device. Well, here's another one. And I found this one very disturbing. Quench your thirst. Scientists suppress neurons that instinctively seek water. Now think about this one. They could just turn those off. Boop, boop, boop. Few little flashes of light. And you will forget to go get a drink when your body needs it. And just after 3 days, you start to run into dehydration issues. And once your body dehydrates to a certain point, your organs begin to shut down. And there is no bringing them back. This could be a very dangerous weapon, people. Another discovery that furthers our understanding of how the brain controls the body's physiological needs. Scientists have identified the neurons that effectively govern the instinct of thirst. Working with mice in the laboratory, the scientists could increase or decrease the amount of water consumed by the test subjects. In a paper appearing online Thursday in the Journal of Science, researchers at Stanford University looked at the median preoptic nucleus. Ding, I think that's some sort of eye connection. Region of the brain that previous research had suggested was linked to the sensation of thirst. However, the exact mechanism behind that link was not understood. The Stanford team of researchers looked at the RNA expression within the median preoptic nucleus, which apart from thirst is also involved in other functions like regulation of sleep and response to decrease in the body's core temperature. Mice were deprived of water for 48 hours, and a cluster of neurons that got excited as a result was identified as an area of interest. Next, the scientist inhibited these neurons from firing using, optogenetics, and found that mice reduced their intake of water correspondingly. By contrast, when those same neurons were photoactivated, even in mice that already had their fill of water, the animals drank more water. Remote control, people. Some mice were trained to press on a lever that would provide them with access to water. And testing various permutations, the scientists found that, quote, the rate of lever pressing corresponded with a decrease in neural activity over time, which suggests that neural activity in the median preoptic nucleus adjusts over time depending on the amount of water intake. However, the feeling of artificially created thirst by firing neurons was still considered an adversive state by the mice, and researchers found that mice provided an opportunity to shut off the photoactivation by pressing a lever, and they did so vigorously, ending the undesirable feeling of thirst. When thirsty animals perform actions that lead to water consumption, which reduces the aversive activity by some amount, these actions are reported until enough water is consumed that the level of aversion ceases to evoke behavior. And in doing so, an association is formed between the particular action and the reduction of the adverse state, which would contribute to making those actions more likely to be repeated when the animal is thirsty again in the future. Now, what kind of horror is this future going to be if they can control living organisms and brain function that are required for survival? Thirst is required by the majority of living things on this planet, and you do need to consume water based on a variety of other brain regions that led to the thirst neurons and what they are connected to. As identified in their research, the Stanford team said the instinct of thirst could translate into, quote, specific goal-directed actions, unquote. This would be making you into a live puppet that they could puppeteer. The research, however, does not suggest that it is healthy or wise to artificially control your thirst by firing the response neuron cluster into your median preoptic nucleus. Of course, do not try this at home. So at least for now, if you are thirsty, just drink some water. This paper is titled, quote, thirst-associated preoptic neurons encode an aversive motivational drive. And an abstract can be read at the link. And I will include this in the notes. So what do you think of them, apples? Guys, this brain research and this brain initiative, thanks Obama, is not going to end up good for you and me. Add to that the 21st Century Cures Act and the neurological disorder monitoring that they want to do. And remember, they stated specifically it would be non-invasive. It's got to make you wonder as we are rolling out all kinds of different biosensors and biosensor applications onto our smart doctor smartphone future devices. So now we're going to talk about applications and devices and artificial intelligence for a moment, because I came across a story this morning that made me laugh. It was a picture of Arnold as a T-800 smiling behind the wheel of a vehicle, and there's a little bubble painted next to him, and it says, I told you I'd be back. Weaponized AI ushers in the Terminator era. And this is even worse than killer robots, guys, because as they are handing all of the secrets of biology over to the machine, like we had read, supercomputing is going to blow the doors off of neurological understanding and being able to feed all the data sets, being able to feed all of our CT and MRI scans into the machine so they can diagnose you. It is going to be even worse. We hand all those frequencies in the spectrogram collaboration challenge to be able to run all of the energy weaponry that's out there. We look back to Cuba, some of the weird things that are going on there. Don't think that we don't have weapons like that in development in this country, because we do. We knew one day we would have to face the prospect of weaponized AI, but now Kalashnikov, and this is a call out to the boys from Primer Time, Michael and Nick, has made a lot of people nervous with its new line of robot soldiers. The Terminator is already here. this was science fiction just a few years ago. It was the stuff of Hollywood fantasy. But now suddenly we are faced with arm robots that can make independent decisions. What's going to happen when the robots are going to be able to push little buttons with flashes of light through your devices, boop, 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 to turn off your aggression complex as a human, to turn off your memory so you don't remember that the machine did something bad? I mean, this is horrifying, guys. This is where our future is headed. And if we don't put a stop to this, if we don't turn off our devices, if we don't disconnect from the machine, this is going to be what we are going to have to live with. Defense departments and private companies are plowing billions of dollars into development, and we are at a tipping point. And soon it'll be too late to turn the tide of artificial intelligence in modern warfare. So we have to deal with the Terminator conundrum, and we have to deal with it now. And this is echoing Elon Musk coming out multiple times over the last few months to raise the red flag with the United Nations and other international agencies and safe AI ethical groups to say we need to stop this machine. The Terminator conundrum is the pet name for a very big problem inside of the White House. The iconic 80s film, The Terminator, AI systems have become self-aware and have turned on the human race, virtually wiping us out. The AI takeover is another euphemism for the terrifying consequences of an AI rising against us. And the tech industry claims that it could really happen and that giving robots free will is a recipe for disaster, especially if they are heavily armed. Global superpowers simply cannot afford to be left behind, though, and the Pentagon is finally earmarking $18 billion over the next 3 years for investment in AI-based warfare. Like nuclear weapons before them, every major superpower will have to develop an arsenal of AI weapons and hope that they never have to use them. But we cannot turn back time, and we cannot uninvent this new technology, especially when it has the power to fight back. And if the UN doesn't act now, it will most certainly be too late, and AI will become an integral part of modern warfare. So would that be a bad thing? Well, the really intriguing part is that the main opposition to weaponized AI is coming from the tech industry that could be making billions of dollars building it. More than 100 robotic experts and industry chiefs have co-signed an open letter to the United Nations pleading with the organization that effectively acts as the world's police to ban all forms of weaponized AI with immediate effect. Lethal autonomous weapons threaten to become the third revolution in warfare, warned the letter. And once developed, they will permit armed conflict to be fought at a scale greater than ever and faster than humans can comprehend. It is the second open letter to the UN. The first was signed by more than 1,000 leading scientists and tech leaders, including Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and Steve Wozniak. This is one of the greatest ethical debates of our time. And the industry that builds the robots is clearly against using them this way. This is a very bad sign. These are the companies working on AI for our homes and our cars, and they are at the cutting edge of this technology, and they do not want to see a gun in a robot's hand. Ding! Neither do I. Tesla's founder, Elon Musk, arguably the face of technology, is a fierce critic of AI, and he firmly believes that the arms race between America, China, and Russia could spark World War III. Terrorists could also subvert AI weaponry by buying it on the black market or hacking it. And Musk says that Russian President Vladimir Putin is also a big supporter of artificial intelligence. And he has gone on record saying that the country that dominates AI will rule the world. He argues that future conflicts could be handled by the machines, which would eliminate human casualties. And I don't think that's going to be the case there, Pooty. When one party's drones are destroyed by the drones of another, they have no choice but to surrender, he says. Well, I don't think it'd be that clean. It sounds rather fanciful and sanitized version of war. America, however, has a different view on AI. The U.S. military has a clear directive that autonomous weapons cannot take lives without the express authorization of a human operator. Essentially, the U.S. military shares the tech industry's reservations and is determined to keep control of any AI systems. General Paul J. Selva, The vice president of the Joint Chiefs of Staff claimed that the U.S. was a decade away from being able to produce a completely independent Terminator-style robot. He swiftly added, though, that the U.S. has no intention of building it. Yeah, right. We must keep the ethical rules of war in place, he says, lest we unleash on humanity a set of robots that we don't know how to control, he says. I don't think it is reasonable for us to put robots in charge of whether or not we take a human life. Even this clear rule gives the U.S. a great deal of leeway, though as a human operator can conceivably authorize a large amount of deadly force with each authorized strike. AI can power military jets and ships, and it can make split-second decisions, take them off a pilot's hand, and control an army of armed drones. The potential is almost limitless. In the end, AI could control vast waves of robot soldiers all at once, and it could make the most efficient choice each and every time and bring an army of drones, armed vehicles, and futuristic robotic soldiers that make the Terminator look like old technology. Ding! AI has the power to predict, strategize, and control a war from anywhere in the world. It is mind-blowing technology, but we just don't know if we can control it. And we have covered enough stories to look at how the dark heart of AI is quite unpredictable, and we don't have reasons why artificial intelligence makes a decision that it does. So we better look out, because it is going to decide that we are vermin and that we are a threat to its existence, and then we are going to become a target. In response to the first open letter, the UN formed an expert panel that would operate under the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, and funding issues mean it simply hasn't made any meaningful progress, and legislators face being left behind by innovators that have already stolen a march. The UN's response to the second open letter is important. America has already started to invest substantial sums. Russia and China are both in the same arms race that could potentially blow up in our face at any time. We've covered Chinese and Russian technology as well. They have been moving forward in leaps and bounds with artificial intelligence, especially in China. China isn't going to be nice about it, I don't think. A ban needs to come soon, or it will simply be too late to turn back the tide of AI weapons that could change the face of modern warfare. Military hardware powered by AI could save lives in the end. And as with the prospect of nuclear war, the sheer presence of AI could be enough to dissuade countries from going to war. But we don't fully understand AI right now, ding, and the arms race between nations is pushing the limits of this technology, and that means it has the potential to go very wrong. So we need to know that we can switch off the machines if they do turn on us, and we need to know that we are the masters of this technology. Kalashnikov's big launch will be the first of many AI-powered prototypes, and if we want to put the brakes on this new concept in modern warfare, then we must do it now. The fate of the human race could rest on these decisions, and it is a big concern that the industry isn't waiting for any UN directive. So it is time for the UN to step up, to engage with the tech world, and to see why the people that build the AI don't think it should be trusted with a loaded gun. We are about to open Pandora's box, but there is still time left to find out how close. Now, I ran across a story this morning that I found pretty interesting, and this is talking about our new military investment. Wow, everything is loading so slow. U.S. military invests $900 million, and this was yesterday, September 18th, 2017. $900 million. On next-generation microchips capable of powering killer AI robots. Yay! And it is our most favorite. Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, has announced six new projects. Count them, six. It'll spend $75 million each year on three research aims. It hopes to enable Moore's Law to continue to apply to microprocessing power. It predicts that the computing power will double roughly every 2 years, and the new technology will be needed for the creation of new advanced AI systems. Killer robots of the future will need more powerful chips to allow them to process vast amounts of data. And the U.S. military has now announced it is investing $900 million on advanced materials and technologies to make this process a reality. It's hope It hopes its efforts will enable 50 years of growth in microprocessing power to continue over the coming century, and it will also allow for the creation of advanced AI systems, ranging from killing machines to cars, planes, and other autonomous technology. Well, thanks, DARPA. Thanks for ensuring the end of the future of the human race. The Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, if I can get there. I'm gonna have to sing. I don't know, this isn't gonna work out. All right, DARPA's Electronics Resurgence Initiative will create 6 new programs over the next 4 years, and these are aimed at ensuring predictions made by Moore's Law, which have governed the increase in microchips processing power, will continue to apply to chip development. These 3 areas will focus on materials and integration, circuit design, and systems architecture. The project will see $75 million spent each year on each of these projects. And the research and development aims, and Bill Chappell, director of the agency's Microsystems Technology Office, says Moore's Law has guided the electronics industry for more than 50 years. Moore's Law has set the technology community on a quest for continued scaling, and those who have mastered the technology to date have enjoyed the greatest commercial benefits and the greatest gains in defense capabilities. The current trajectory is straining commercial and defense developments, and Gordon Moore was one of the giants in microelectronics revolution and was the co-founder of Fairchild Semiconductors and Intel. So make it smaller, faster, smarter. In 1965, Moore famously predicted that the transistor count of integrated circuits would double every year or two, while the cost per transistor would decrease. This prediction that computing power would double roughly every 2 years has proven to be accurate, and it has been used in the microchip industry to guide long-term planning and set targets for research and development. But rising manufacturing costs and limitation of existing chip technologies mean that new avenues of research are needed for this pace to continue for future growth. And it follows an announcement in June that the U.S. military is investing $65 million into a program to develop a what-a-hoa brain chip, allowing humans to simply plug into a computer. And it says the systems could give soldiers super senses and help treat people with blindness, paralysis, or speech disorders. The goal is developing an implantable system that is able to provide precision communications between the brain and the digital world, says DARPA. So there you go. DARPA wants to connect you to the machine and to develop technologies to be able to make killer robots. Well, let's read about Kalashnikov and exactly what their new AI-directed machine gun is going to do. I couldn't believe it when I saw that. You knew that was coming. Kalashnikov will make an AI-powered killer robot. Russian weapons maker Kalashnikov is working on an automated gun system that uses artificial intelligence to make shoot-no-shoot decisions. But exactly how this AI or any other decides who is a combatant and who isn't at the heart of a raging debate over allowing autonomous weapons on the battlefield filled with both soldiers and civilians. The Kalashnikov combat module will include a 7.62mm machine gun coupled with a camera attached to a computer system. Ding, ding, robot googly eyes. According to TASS, the module uses, quote, neural network technologies that enables it to identify targets and make decisions. A key part of neural networking technology is the ability to learn from past mistakes. Bad robot, he was a civilian, you shouldn't have killed him. Neural networks are computer systems that learn much like animal brains, learning from example and then using what it learned to make decisions in the future. And a battlefield robot, for example, may store images of both soldiers, guerrillas, and unarmed citizens in an onboard database. And once its onboard cameras image a human being, the neural network would compare the person to the one that it is seeing in the database. And if it has a firearm or a uniform worn by an enemy troop, it would open fire. And ideally, if it saw no weapon at all, it would judge the target civilian and not open fire. The problem with example-based learning in warfare is that in war, mistakes are permanent and irreversible, unless, of course, you use some sort of non-lethal energy weaponry. Ding! And the neural network may not have an opportunity to apply its lessons learned. If the robot misjudges a rocket launcher as a broomstick and doesn't fire, the rocket launcher will blow it up. That doesn't help the robot, and it won't help future robots learn to discern a soldier with rockets from a civilian with a broomstick, unless, of course, they give it some sort of cloud learning, which we have learned about before in, someone remembers, what was that robot's name? He had a cloud learning, and he was a robotic assembly line robot. Anyway, if one learned, they all learned. And if a civilian's pitchfork is misidentified as a rocket launcher, he gets riddled with bullets. And if a neural network then self-tweaks itself to identify a pitchfork, that's good for the robot, but the civilian is still dead. A combat module appears to mount a PKMT 7.62 millimeter machine gun, and the PKMT is an adaptation of the PK infantry machine gun for armored vehicles, and it can fire conventional tracer and armor piercing incendiary rounds to an effective range of 1500 meters. Kalashnikov doesn't state where the combat module will be used or if it could find itself on the BAS-01G Sorknek, which is Comrade-in-Arms 7-ton semi-autonomous robotic fighting vehicle, or the 20-ton robotic vehicle the company is also developing. Another possibly less dangerous application for civilians anyway could be installing the system onto tanks to automatically identify and kill anti-tank weapons. Yeah. Well, that's a good one. So let's enable AI in killing. That seems to be the newest thing to do. I found something out of the DeepMind blog this morning. That is DeepMind, Google's AI. AI in neuroscience, a virtuous circle, according to Google's DeepMind. Recent progress in AI has been remarkable. Artificial systems now outperform expert humans at Atari video games. In the ancient board game Go and high-stakes matches of heads of poker, they can also produce handwriting and speech indistinguishable from those of humans, translate between multiple languages without human assistance, and even create their own language, and reformat your holiday snapshots in the style of Vincent van Gogh masterpieces. These advances are attributed to several factors, including the application of new statistical approaches and the increased processing power of computers. Ding, ding. But in a recent perspective in the journal Neuron, we argue that one of the often overlooked contributions is the use of ideas from experimental and theoretical neuroscience. Uh-oh. Psychology and neuroscience have played a key role in the history of AI. Founding figures such as Donald Hebb, Warren McCullough, and Martin Minsky and Jeff Hinton were originally motivated by a desire to understand how the brain works. And in fact, throughout the late 20th century, many of the key work developing neural networks took place not in mathematics or a physics lab, but in a psychology and a neuropsychology department. At DeepMind, we argue that despite rapid progress in both fields, researchers should not lose sight of this vision. We urge researchers in neuroscience and AI to find a common language, allowing a free flow of knowledge that will allow continued progress on both fronts. We believe that drawing inspiration from neuroscience and AI research is important for two reasons. First, neuroscience can help validate AI techniques that already exist. Put simply, if we discover one of our artificial intelligence algorithms mimics a function within the brain, it suggests that our approach may be on the right track. Second, neuroscience can provide a rich source of inspiration for new types of algorithms and architectures to employ when building artificial brains. Ding! And traditional approaches to AI have historically been dominated by long logic-based methods. In theoretical mathematical models, we argue that neuroscience can complement these by identifying classes of biological computation that might be critical to cognitive functions. Yeah, find a way to manipulate the brain. And you know what? NVIDIA is at an all-time high as Merrill Lynch is gushing over the future investment in artificial intelligence and where that is going to leave us. NVIDIA hits another all-time high as Wall Street gushes over AI opportunity. The analysts are saying that NVIDIA is going to go up, up, and up from 210 to maybe 250, its highest ever. And this technology, as it is rolling out into our daily lives, there are some of us who have participated. There are some of us who haven't. There are some of us that have kind of been a hybrid. But the sad fact of the matter is, and I have to thank Jack Blood for posting this story yesterday. Let's get it to load because I got a little quote loaded up here. Oh, well, I guess not anymore. Hold on. I hate when this happens. We'll have to do our little music. Hold on. I'm pedaling and I'm singing. I'm on a little fit desk, fit bike. It's been a little difficult, but it actually is good because I'm not sitting with my legs still. They're always moving. Oh, come on. I wish I could pedal and make the screen move. Oh, here it comes. Okay, Apple's i10. Apple's i10. Okay, so the technology is out there. And like I said, some of us participated, some of us haven't, some of us have done somewhat of a hybrid. But listen to this quotation. Once a technical innovation has been introduced, people usually become dependent upon it so that they can never again do without it unless it is replaced by some more advanced innovation. Not only do people become dependent as individuals on the new item of technology, but even more so, the system as a whole becomes dependent upon it, which then forces you to become a consumer of that technology in order to interact with society. And that was the Unabomber's quote. This is a story out of the Chicago Tribune. Like I said, thanks to Jack Blood for posting this yesterday. The iPhone X proves that the Unabomber was right. The introduction of the new iPhone X, which features wireless charging, facial recognition, and a price tag of $999, appears to be a minor event with a